You're listening to a thoroughly good podcast made for the Women's Royal Army Corps Association, celebrating women who serve, a podcast series that spotlights, celebrates and honours the pioneering women who have served and are serving in the Army. My name is John Jacob. I'm a writer and a podcaster and normally spend the majority of my time immersing myself in the joys of classical music. I talk to musicians about their work and the music they love, and I reflect on the way their work impacts on me as a listener. This podcast series, commissioned by the Women's Royal Army Corps Association, is something a little different for me. It's an exploration of the lives of some of the women who have served and are serving in the Army. An opportunity to celebrate their contribution and understand how they've driven change in one of this country's most vital of institutions. It's a series of conversations with Army veterans who reflect on their careers and subsequent lives, providing insights and observations on their experiences during the Second World War and beyond. Because for people like me, whilst I could read a book to gain an understanding of what life was like then, it seems far more appealing to me and more engaging to listen to someone provide their first-hand experiences. Perhaps one of the things which often surprises me about interviewing anybody is the experience of listening. When you're interviewing somebody like, say, the Army veteran you're about to hear in this podcast, Daphne Bauer, it's very important to ask short questions that trigger the memory and also don't take too long to explain. When you've done that, you need to get out of the way. You need to listen. Often, what I hear is the voice at the other end of the phone, all at once, vulnerable, honest, and perhaps even a little childlike in its willingness to engage. Something magical happens when you start to listen. At the same time as listening to that, there's the need to listen to one's own internal voice at the same time. The result, when recording an interview like this, can at first be slightly disappointing. There is an equivalent, like a musician performing a solo perhaps and then stepping off the stage. The moments directly after the experience can leave one feeling a little flat. But listening to that same exchange a few weeks back, as I have, results in an entirely different experience, and one that raises questions, challenges assumptions, and shapes perspectives. Here then, in this interview with Daphne, who was stationed at Kedleston Hall during the Second World War, where she and other women were charged with distributing intercepted German messages that were sent to Bletchley Park. When I hear this, I hear a person who is able to provide evocative detail that transports me to a place in time I've no personal experience of myself. It helps shape my perspective of what it must have been like. I hear descriptive talk of mess hall menus, her own father's war injuries, and life on the Isle of Man. But in addition to that, and perhaps most importantly for me, I hear about the motivations that drove her to make the decision she did to sign up in the first place. Service, for me, at this point in the podcast series, is something which seemed to offer opportunity, an alternative to the expectations and conventions of Daphne's present day. It promised a sense of purpose that other walks of life perhaps didn't at the time. I've approached speaking to all of the Army veterans in this series, assuming that it was their time in the services which then offered opportunities to women in later generations. It did, of course, but actually, what circumstance combined with need on the eve of the Second World War offered women like Daphne was an alternative at a point in time when a generation had already identified an implicit dissatisfaction with their lot in life. The services, then, were in the right place at the right time.
My father worked for the Liverpool Vic Insurance Company. He was manager of their actuarial department in Southampton Row, London. And my mother, she didn't work, but she had been a nurse. And I was the only child for almost 13 years. And then we moved from Forest Gate out to Gidea Park. And a few months later, my mother gave birth to twin boys.
So you were born in 1932, is that right?
1925.
Oh, 1925. Okay.
Yes, I'm coming up to 95 now.
So I ask you all of that because my mum was born very close to Forest Gate, a few years after you, but she was evacuated during the war,
yes,
and she talks very fondly.
Several times and went back. Initially, we went to North Devon, and then we went back because there was a phony war, and we went back, and I went back to school, and then. We started getting raids and we went down to South Devon and it quietened down and we all came back again. Then we went down to Devon again.
What was your experience of being evacuated?
Oh, fine. We had we lived in the village of Gampton, which is between Paignton and Brixham, near Churston. We lived in the village there and my father had to pay £9 for me to leave school under the age of 16 because I'd gone to grammar school on a scholarship. And I worked for the Prudential Assurance Company that had evacuated to Torquay.
Wow.
Then we went back to London. We went back to Romford and Gidea Park. And I went up to Holborn for a short while, and I was in St John's Ambulance Nursing Cadets, and my mother said, either do it properly or don't do it at all. So I gave that up and tried nursing for 3 months and didn't gel with me. So I joined the ATS. I was trained as an intercept operator, wireless operator. I intercepted German messages, which at the time it was top secret, and it wasn't till late 1970 that I found that those messages, which we knew went off somewhere on a motorbike, went to Bletchley Park for decoding.
So when your mum said if you're going to do it properly, was that what she said?
Of me, what she called tinkering with nursing. She said either do it properly or not at all.
Goodness me! Well, she sounds like she was a formidable woman.
Yes, in many ways, she was very kind and very good, but she was very Victorian. I was given permission to get married under the age of 21 on the condition I didn't start a family.
Right.
I
don't know why that makes me laugh, but I hope that you intended to make me laugh when you told me that. And you said so. You sound like a rule breaker, Daphne.
Oh dear. I'm not feeling too good at the moment. So it's nice to chat to someone and have a giggle.
Can you just give me a picture of what your parents were like? I mean, your dad sounds as though he was successful.
My father was an officer in St John of Ambulance Brigade. He was a district officer, and then he became assistant commissioner at Number One District. He was one of the first civilians ever trained in ARP back in. Well, Mum always said we had 4 years more war than anybody else because he started ARP training as a civilian, but as an officer in the brigade.
What was ARP
training in 1935?
What was ARP training?
And then air raid precautions. And then he went out to. He ran weekend courses to train other officers in the brigade, to went back to train the St John's divisions in first aid. Well, not in first aid, they were trained in first aid in being air raid wardens and all that sort of thing, you know? And, of course, gas was the big sort of threat then. They thought the Germans would use gas. And I remember he and Mum designing gas-proof clothing, and our dining room and Mum's machine, where she was machining oilcloth together, horrible smell, where she was, they were designing protective clothing. Of course, that didn't come to anything, but that's what happened. And Dad got the OBE in the 1937 Coronation Honours for the work he'd done in training people of St John Ambulance Brigade.
So there was clearly a sense of, there was already a sense of duty in your family.
Yes, yes. Dad had been, he only had, I think, about a year in the army, but he, and he was posted to France during the First World War, but he got frostbitten feet, they call it trench feet, so he came back and was in a military hospital in Ealing until he could walk again. I understood that he'd met Mum, I don't know quite how, but she helped him learn to walk again by dancing with him. That sounds strange, but that, I think she gradually got him up on his feet, trying to dance and get him to start moving. Yeah, and he always had white, spongy feet as a result of having these frozen feet.
And what about your mum? You said that she was very kind and very generous.
Oh, yes, yes. And she was a wonderful housekeeper and an excellent cook. And she didn't go to work. They had me and that was it. And then, of course, she had the boys. But she died when the boys were 10. And one of the boys died 2 years later. And the other boy died last month. He was 82, or just coming up to 82.
I'm very sorry.
And he was his funeral last Wednesday. He died April the 20th, and his funeral was on last Wednesday, the 27th. Yes, and he caught this ruddy virus.
I want to just take you back to when you decided to sign up for the ATS. What influenced you? What persuaded you? I understand. I realise that your mum was keen for you to do something, but yeah, what made you think? But what made you think I would do the ATS?
Yes. Well, then I went back to the Pru for about 6 weeks, and I thought, nah, I've got to do something. They're going to call me up when I get to 18, and I was 17 and a half. So I went, I fancied going in the Wrens, you know, a teenager and their uniform and that sort of thing. But they could only offer me being a steward, and I wasn't going to be a steward.
What was being a steward? What did that mean?
Well, waiting at table and things.
Oh, I see. Okay, right. Me.
So I decided I would look at the Women's Air Force, and I would look at the Auxiliary Territorial Service. I went to the ATS first, and I accepted the Queen's Shilling, or the King's Shilling rather, then, of course, the King's Shilling, and joined the ATS. I went in 2 days after my 18th birthday. went to Wigston Magna in Leicester for my basic training. And then that was about 3 weeks. And then was sent up to New Brighton for selection. And because I had been a brownie and had done semaphore and Morse, and also because I'd played the piano, I was selected as a wireless operator.
Because you had played the piano?
Yes, I had. I couldn't play it now if you paid me, but never mind, I did it at the time. And then I was posted to the Isle of Man to do my wireless training.
What was it?
I didn't send Morse, I only received Morse.
What was the experience of doing your training? Were there any surprises? Because that's about adjusting to a different way of life.
Training I love, because I'm one of those peculiar people who like square bashing and regimentation and that sort of thing. And then on the Isle of Man, we did learn to receive Morse. And gradually got faster at it, so we had to be able to read what they called 25 words a minute, but which really wasn't words, it was five letter or five figure blocks. So, of course, we didn't know what it was all in code, and it went, as I say, it went to the big place and or somewhere, Station X, and it wasn't till years later that I found out it was Bletchley. And from 1992 until a couple of years ago, I used to go to the annual reunion at Bletchley Park. But
at the time when you were working, when you were decoding and these messages were being sent on, you had no sense of what it was you were doing or why you were doing it. You were just performing.
No, we knew we were intercepting German messages, but we didn't do the decoding. We just took these messages down, intercepted them, and they went off by dispatch rider to wherever they were sent to. Which we now know was Bletchley.
Does it surprise you that when I hear you tell me that, that obviously makes me think that it must have been very exciting? But I wonder whether your day-to-day experience was not
It wasn't exciting, it was boring. Because sometimes you were given a frequency. We worked in eight-hour shifts, you see, and you were given a frequency which you had to cover. And sometimes that frequency was silent and then it would burst into, Germans sending messages to one another. One of my friends heard them speak in plain language once, and that was when we were bombing Casino Monastery, and she heard young Germans crying for their mums. Because we were bombing hell out of Casino Monastery, where they were hiding up. But no, it was just these Morse messages. We didn't have a clue what it was about, really.
And what was day to day? What was what was day to day life like for you doing that?
Day to day life. Oh, it was okay. Especially when we were on the Isle of Man, because the island lived up to its name. I mean, there were great big training camps there, RAF training camps. Near the docks at Douglas, there was an officers' training unit. So there were wonderful dances and no shortage of fellas, so we were always going out dancing and enjoying stuff. And the highlight of food-wise, was when we saw a boat come in to Douglas from Ireland, because we'd know then that there was a load of eggs. So we'd shoot down to Douglas, and it was absolute nectar to have fried eggs and chips because the canned food was bloody awful at the time. In fact, if you have fish cakes for breakfast, solid porridge and then fish cakes. it was fun in a way, many ways. It was fun.
Yeah, the menu sounds awful, I have to tell you.
Well, that's it was rationing, wasn't it, and that? So, of course, when we got the egg boat coming from Ireland, whew, that was fantastic.
That's really but that's really important for somebody like me, because obviously that's an experience that I mean, we had a little bit of it about 2 months ago when there were no eggs and there's no flour and everybody was running around going, oh my goodness me, it's the end of the world, but that was commonplace then.
Oh yes, there was some rationing anyway.
Did you have to adjust? You know, when you went to the Isle of Man, did you have to adjust to a different way of life? You said that you enjoyed the discipline.
No, I suppose in a way I did, but I took it on board. I'm a bit like that. I just went with it, went with the flow.
Do you recall what happened when the war came to an end? Do you remember where you were when you heard that the war had come to an end?
Oh yes, I got my daughter, about 3 or 4 months old, and I was living at home with mum and dad. Ken was still in the army. He didn't get discharged till 1946 because he was regular army. He'd done 10 years with the colours. So he'd been in the army from 1936 to 46. And he was 7 years older than me. Mm.
How did you meet? How did you meet your husband?
We met on the Isle of Man at a dance. At a dance on the Isle of Man. And we met on Sunday. I had a date with him on the Tuesday, and that happened to be Valentine's Day. We were walking on the beach, and there was a hell of a noise coming from one of the dance halls, and he said, whatever's going on over there? I said, well, it's a special night tonight. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, this is the night the girls propose to fellas. So he laughed. He said, you better try it on. So for a joke, I did. And I'd only known him 48 hours. And to me, it was a joke. But we stayed together and we got engaged in the May. And I'd always wanted an Easter wedding. So this was 1944. Yeah, 1944. Anyway, and... I joined up in 43. Anyway, we got engaged in the May, and I wanted to get married the following year at Easter. But then he was posted from the Isle of Man to Shenley in Hertfordshire, and was threatened with... It was just about D-Day, and they reckoned he was going to be sent overseas again. So we got special license and got married on June the 17th. So it's coming up to what would have been my 76th wedding anniversary this month.
Wow. What did your parents make of your rapid proposal and your rapid wedding?
They didn't like it at all. They didn't like it. And they weren't happy with Ken at the time either, you know, but... They grew to my mum didn't know him all that long, really, he was all right after a while. We were married almost 42 years. We survived. It wasn't a perfect marriage, but then, if we're honest, you always get ups and downs.
So when
it was fine, we were together almost 42 years.
When the war was when the end of the war was announced, do you recall how you felt at the time?
Well, relieved, but also annoyed that I couldn't go up to London and just celebrate because I was stuck out at Gidea Park with the baby.
How very honest. I always like it. I always like it when I do always like it when mothers are honest about, you know, I've got this baby, but actually it's a bit of a pain in the moment. Yeah, I really like that. So there was
a temporary thing, of course, but that baby is now 75.
Gracious. Gracious me. So there was absolutely a sense of euphoria about the end of the war. But did you, at that point...
Also the horrible thing about it's still going on out in the Far East. And I had got a cousin who died a Japanese prisoner of war. He was POW of the Japs. He was imprisoned in Sumatra. I think it's got another name now, isn't it? Sumatra, it wasn't. And he had bacterial dysentery and died as a POW. Mm. But otherwise, as a family, we came off quite lightly, really.
After the end of the war, how long was it before you began to understand what role you had played? Receiving how long was it before you began to understand what role you had played?
When before I knew what I'd been
interested. Yes, exactly.
Not until it was released in the late 1970s.
And when you gained an understanding in the late 70s, what was your initial reaction to that? Were you surprised? Were you proud? What was your reaction to that?
I suppose I was proud, but then I hadn't done it for very long. I mean, I have given talks on this, and I have emphasised that I was only a very, very small cog in a big wheel because I got pregnant and... I came out after a while, so I've always given the talks on behalf of all those other girls who did it for much longer than me. You know, it's not what I did, but what the section, we were called the Y Service, section of the Royal Signals. We were Auxiliary Territorial Service attached to Royal Signals / Intelligence Corps.
That's quite some title. It's quite a long title, isn't it?
Well, it is really, yes, but that's what it amounted to.
And how many others were there in that section?
Oh, thousands. Thousands, I'm sure. Because it wasn't just in this country, it was throughout the world. There were WAFs who did it, there were WRENs who did it, and of course Army, Navy and Air Force men did it. So, you know, it was a worldwide thing that they intercepted others. Yeah, German and Japanese. My husband had got wind that I might be put onto learning Japanese traffic, which was entirely different from the Germans, but thank God I didn't have to do that.
When you look back on your time doing this work, what makes you feel most proud?
What makes me feel proud? Oh, I don't know. The fact that I did a small amount towards victory, and it was a small amount, and I emphasise that all the time. It was a minuscule amount, really. I was proud of what my section had done, not just me, but, yeah, that it was about a feeling of pleasure having done it, yeah.
And this may be a little bit difficult, but do you recall anything that really made you laugh during that time?
Made me laugh?
Mm.
Oh, gosh. I was happy, but I don't think I can recall anything outstanding that made me have a good old giggle. I can't remember.
Who were your best friends during that time?
Well, it was difficult, really, because you were in small numbers and you worked and then you went off duty and you went to bed. You were sort of 4 days on duty and 2 days off. And it was, as I say, it was 8-hour shifts. So it wasn't a time to make deep friends, not in the time I was there, really, in all honesty. I've made more friends since. People who weren't just doing wire service, because I became a member of the Women's Royal Army Corps Association, which incorporated members of the ATS. And when I moved down here, I joined a branch here in Bournemouth. I used to belong to a branch in Ilford, outside London, but when I came here, I joined the local branch here, and within the year, I became secretary of the branch, and then the treasurer gave up. She went out to South Africa, so I took on treasurer. So in the end, I did it for 12 years, till I was in my late 80s, and I was secretary, treasurer, and as well, so...
And a glutton for punishment, then.
I enjoyed it. Yes, that's why I get so frustrated at the moment, because I can hardly move.
That will return, I'm sure.
I've done my bit.
Yeah, I've come to the end of my questions. I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to say that I haven't asked you about.
I think we've covered most things, don't you?
Well, I think so too.
Please ring me again.
But maybe I will. Maybe we'll just have another chat. Thank you very much for your time, Daphne. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, good, good. And you've cheered me up, because I've had a bit of the blues today.
Well, then yes. We must speak again. We must absolutely speak again. You've been listening to Women Who Serve, a podcast series that spotlights, celebrates and honours the pioneering women who have served and are serving in the Army. It was a thoroughly good production for the Women's Royal Army Corps Association.